Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is an historic time.
This is going to be a multi-year fight.
Why is it taking so long to get a screening test?
It is not a hoax. It is real.
Something that we have never experienced before.
Wash hands, wash hands, wash hands.
I mean, you're the scientist. You're going to have to tell me.
Welcome to Science Rules Coronavirus Edition. I'm your host, Bill Nye, and this is the series that brings you the latest analysis and the science of this pandemic to keep you informed, prepared, and calm. We are still all in this together, my friends. And when I say we're all in this together, of course, I mean together in the abstract. We haven't been able to be physically together with many of our closest friends and relatives for quite some time. Now, how has all this social distancing been affecting us, both mentally and physically? Here to help us understand this is Julianne Holt-Lundstad. She's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University, where she studies how relationships and loneliness affect our health. Dr. Holt-Lundstad, welcome to Science Rules Coronavirus Edition. May I call you Julianne?
Yes, of course. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
So how does this pandemical disruption affect us? How is it affecting our health, our long-term relationships, and so on?
Wow. Well, that's a big question, right?
Well, you start wherever you want. Start wherever you want.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, I've spent my entire career looking at, you know, the extent to which we are socially connected can have protective effects, and conversely, how being socially isolated and lonely have detrimental effects. And now we are in this situation where we have the seemingly contradictory kinds of messages that, you know, on the one hand, being with others is good for our health, but at the same time, we need to social distance in order to protect ourselves from the virus. And so we're, you know, really trying to understand how these current restrictions that affect our ability to connect with others are going to have both immediate effects as well as what are the long-term implications.
So how does it affect us? You wrote this paper that loneliness, wait a second, loneliness is as bad for you as smoking 15 cigarettes a day?
Well,
that seems really bad for you. Over decades, in other words, loneliness will get you.
Well, let me give you a little bit of background on where that comparison comes from. So I've done two major meta-analyses, and I know you know what they are, but maybe for your listeners, familiar with what a meta-analysis is really that's combining the data from all of the available evidence worldwide. In the first meta-analysis, we looked at all of the available evidence worldwide on the extent to which people are socially connected and how long they live. So these studies follow people over years, often decades. So on average, they followed people for 7.5 years.
Do they use this term longitudinal? Is that a word?
Yes. Yeah. So
it means a long
longitudinal
time.
Methods. Yes. Yeah. These are large scale studies. So
how big is large scale?
Yeah. So my first meta-analysis included over 300,000 people. And the second one included over 3.4 million people.
That's pretty meta.
Yeah.
As Meta goes. That's big. That's big picture. So go ahead.
Yeah. So in this first one, what we found was that people who were more socially connected had a 50% increased odds of survival. And so, you know, when we found that finding, we knew, okay, most people aren't going to know what that means or how to contextualize it in terms of how just how important it is for our health. So that's where we started. We decided we needed to benchmark it relative to other kinds of risk factors that we do take very seriously for our health. And so when we looked across all of these variety of ways that we can connect to others, what we found was that that effect on, you know, how long we live, that risk for mortality, that was comparable to, you know, as you mentioned, smoking up to 15 cigarettes per day. I mean, that's the one that seems to get cited quite often, but we also compared it to physical inactivity, obesity, a flu vaccine, air pollution, you know, all of these things that we take really quite seriously. And then in the second meta-analysis, we looked specifically at social deficits. So all these indicators of lacking social connection, like social isolation, loneliness, and living alone. And what we found was that loneliness was associated with a 26% increase risk of earlier death, social isolation, 29%, and living alone, 32%.
So a quarter to a third.
Yeah. So these indicators of these social deficits, so lonely, being alone, do carry these significant risks. You know, the social deficits, interestingly, were not quite as strong as the protective effects of being socially connected.
What do you mean by that? So being connected is good, but being not connected is not as bad as it as good kind of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, we looked at the effect of a variety of ways of looking at this, right? And not all studies look at it in the same way. You know, I often ask my students to come up with all the different ways you could possibly measure people's level of social connection or their relationships. And, you know, it can include things like the size of one's social network, the extent to which they perceive their relationships to be supportive, whether or not they live alone.
To me, that's the question, is cause and effect. In other words...
Oh, yeah. Okay, we can get into that.
Does being alone make you eat too much and not get enough exercise? Or does not eating well and not getting exercise make you alone in this one example?
Yeah. So we can talk about, you know, various health outcomes. Cardiovascular outcomes are actually one of the stronger ones.
Heart attack kind of thing, you mean?
Yeah. And stroke is another big one. And
so you're saying that lonely people have worse heart health.
Yeah. We have good evidence that those who are socially isolated and lonely are at significantly higher risk for heart disease and stroke.
Okay, so that's correlation, but is it causation, as we love to ask?
Right. That's a really important question, because I think what you're asking is it that being isolated or alone can make us less healthy, or are people who are less healthy more likely to be alone and lonely?
Exactly. There you go. Yeah.
Right. And that direction is really important. And so, first of all, there's a number of ways to address that issue. And in my own research, one of the ways to address the directionality of that is the fact that we use longitudinal studies. Because people were assessed initially in terms of their level of social connection, isolation, or loneliness, and then followed over time to see who was alive and who was dead, or who was sick and who was well, we understand the time course of that. It's the social isolation that's predicting the poor health and not the other way around. And so what we found is, even controlling for initial health status, so regardless of how healthy or unhealthy someone was, the more socially connected they were, the more likely they were to be alive. And, you know, the more socially isolated or lonely they were, the more likely they were to be dead at the follow-up or have...
to be dead. More likely to be dead. So here's the question. This is the coronavirus edition of Science Rules. So how is the pandemic doing? What is it doing to us, to people?
That is a great question, because most of the evidence that we have is looking at these effects long term. And so, you know, it's interesting because I think initially back in March and April, even, we thought that this was going to be maybe a few weeks. You know, when I was interviewed about this in the first few weeks of the pandemic, most of the journalists that were talking to me were really only interested in what are the immediate effects, as if this were only going to last, as if these restrictions were only going to last very short term, but what kinds of short term effects. And I think what's becoming more clear is that although we don't know exactly the extent to the duration of some of these restrictions, it is clear that it's definitely beyond the acute phase. And what kinds of effects are happening in our bodies physiologically and how that develops over time to influence risk and to eventually become more chronic issues.
So two questions. What do you mean by the acute phase? I think I know what you mean, but what do you mean by the acute phase?
You know, very broadly speaking, humans are a social species. Many in neuroscience, for instance, have looked into the idea that our brains have adapted to expect the presence of others, this idea of a social baseline, and that when we lack proximity to others, this, in essence, is associated with a heightened state of alert. So, for example, you know, we would need to be more vigilant to potential threats in our environment, or that we, you know, would need to exert more effort because we might need to handle whatever challenges in our environment on our own because others may not be around us.
That's why the ship has somebody standing watch. That's why we have guard duty, and so it's much easier to sleep when you're not anxious. So is aloneness, or being alone rather, associated not just with alert, but with a state of higher anxiety also?
Yeah. So in addition to, you know, our brains being more active and alert, this signals areas in our periphery that also heighten a state alert, which includes things like heightened blood pressure, heightened heart rates, and circulating stress hormones. And so we've found in some of our laboratory-based studies that even just putting an individual in a challenging kind of stressful situation is enough to heighten these physiological processes as well as one's anxiety levels as well. And so we have this immediate reaction to cope with the challenges that are in our environment. And while that is an immediate reaction, the extent to which that reaction becomes sustained and prolonged, that can sustain wear and tear on our body. And so the key here now is to determine to what extent are people able to remain resilient in the face of these challenges and stressors. And what's ironic is that in my research, what we've found, one of the biggest ways to help buffer or blunt some of these heightened reactions to stress is social support. Researchers have argued that you know, loneliness is a biological motive, somewhat like hunger and thirst.
Do you agree with that?
Well, there is some evidence to suggest. So for instance, recently a study out of MIT found that 10 hours of isolation showed a similar neurosignature as going without food for the same length of time.
So hang on. Is isolation the same as loneliness? Is being alone the same as being isolated?
That's a great question, because a lot of people use the terms interchangeably as if they mean the same thing. And that's because they often can go together. They can go hand in hand, but not always. And social isolation is really more thought to be objective. So it's having fewer infrequent social contact.
So you were asked about the pandemic in April of 2020. Mm-hmm. What predictions did you make? What did you say was going to happen? And then what happened?
One of the things that I had really hoped for was a greater awareness and appreciation for our social relationships. Early on, I saw a lot of efforts to really make an effort to look out for those most vulnerable in our communities. We saw a lot, at least in the media, in terms of singing on balconies and cheering for hospital workers and, you know, rainbows and teddy bears and windows, really to, you know, buoy people up in this tough time. And I've seen a lot less of that. And I worry that people are becoming fatigued and frustrated. That can sustain wear and tear on our body.
We'll be back right after this.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Is it a real, like, horrible thing that this isolation and being alone are affecting our immune system? Are actually more people getting infected than would have otherwise? Like, you know, everybody talks about how crazy contagious this virus is. Is this making it even more contagious?
Well, so there is some interesting research out of Carnegie Mellon. Sheldon Cohen has done 35 years of research looking at susceptibility to viruses and vulnerability to upper respiratory illnesses. So, I mean, granted, it was using the common cold virus and flu virus, but it has implications for the COVID-19. And what his research suggests is that, first of all, those who are under more chronic stress are more susceptible and more vulnerable to viruses. But interestingly, those who are more socially connected and those who have more diverse social networks are less susceptible. So I think the big question is, how do we remain socially connected while still maintaining the
physical distance? Yeah.
The physical distancing. And so one area of research that we can draw on is there's a body of research around perceived social support. And some of my research, for instance, in my meta-analysis, we found that perceptions of social support were associated with a 35% increased odds of survival. In those studies I mentioned earlier, where we brought people into the lab and connected them up to physiological equipment and then had them do some kind of challenging task that is very stressful.
What'd they have to do? Solve a puzzle or get a shock or look at the marshmallow without eating it?
It varied anywhere from kinds of arithmetic tasks to public speaking to talking about a stressful event. There are a variety of stressors that we used. But what was interesting is that what we found was that people who reported that they had more supportive people in their social network, in essence, this idea that we can count on others, had much lower cardiovascular reactivity to the stressful event. So their stress reactions were dampened. And what this suggests is this idea that we are better able to manage and cope and respond to the challenges that we face if we know that there are people in our lives that we can count on, even if they're not there at the moment, that just knowing we can count on them is enough to have that effect on our physiology. Of course, we know much less about Zoom in particular because it's a relatively recent technology, but we've done experiments where we've contrasted and actually manipulated how people's friends have behaved towards them to see if that influences their responses, to even just having an individual imagine a friend and how that affects physiology, even if they're not there. And what's interesting is that our perceptions of these other people, you know, whether it's friends or a coworker or
Wilson the volleyball, if you saw that
right,
movie.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. It's our perceptions that really seem to drive that physiology. And in fact, in one study, we had participants wear portable blood pressure monitors throughout their everyday lives for 3 days and take measurements, you know, during every single social interaction. And what we found was that that blood pressure was driven primarily based on how they feel about that person normally and less on the quality of that specific interaction. And so those global perceptions of those others, the extent to which you feel like you can trust that person, that can have an important influence on our physiology.
What should we do about this? Let's say you have proven beyond any reasonable doubt that feeling lonely is bad for you, shortens your life somehow. What should we do about it?
So first of all, making sure that the people who, if you live with others, nurturing those relationships, making sure that the time you spend with the people that you live with is high quality time. Because of
what
course,
if they drive you crazy? What if they're
exactly
just crazy?
Because stress, you know, relationships can be can help us cope with stress, but they can also be sources of stress for sure. And in fact, negativity in relationships can increase risk and has been shown across studies to increase risk. And so really it's, you know, time spent in high quality kinds of interactions. So, you know, if you don't live with others, or even if you do live with others, we also need to, you know, spend time with people outside the home. So how do we do that safely? It may be that you have, you know, conversations with a neighbor across the street or across a balcony at a safe distance. Picking up the phone, getting on a video chat or you know, texting someone to check in with them, see how they're doing. One of the things that research has shown is that providing support to others, being a source of support to others, not only helps them, you know, to booster that sense of perceived social support, but providing support also may have even a stronger benefit on the person who's providing it. So it helps them and it helps you.
What was it like during the Spanish flu in 1918? Were people having the same issues?
You know, you're the first one to have asked me that question.
Really?
Yes, yes. You know, it's interesting because systematic study of social isolation and loneliness really didn't start till much later. There is a very classic study done by a sociologist, Durkheim, that was done in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that found that people who were more socially isolated were more likely to die of suicide. And so that was one of the very first studies to demonstrate any link. It wasn't until much later, really in the 1970s, that systematic study began looking at how this might relate to disease-related causes of death. One similar sort of case is the last 3 summers, I have been a director of an international studies program where I've brought students to other cultures to explore kind of what factors influence behavior and health. And among the locations we visited are these, you know, so-called blue zones or hot spots of longevity. And what's unique about these communities, where they have centenarians in higher proportions than other parts of the population, is in each case, they are very remote villages.
So they're isolated.
In a way, they're very isolated, and yet they're very tightly connected communities. And they really look out for each other.
So what about this mythic thing that everybody loves to talk about? Extroverts versus introverts.
Yeah.
Do introverts have an edge here? Are they already self-isolating in a way?
You know, there's the assumption that introverts maybe aren't suffering, but extroverts are extra, you know, having a really rough time during the pandemic. And actually, data does not bear that out.
Oh, wow. So listen, introverts, extroverts, yeah. Get over it. We're all in this together.
So data even before the pandemic showed that introverts are no less at risk for isolation and loneliness. And there's some data to suggest that they may actually be at increased risk. But there's also international data that has been collected. You know, of course, all of this is preliminary. It was collected in some of the early weeks of the pandemic. But what that data suggested is that actually extroverts were faring better and coping better overall.
So is the pandemic changing us?
This is something I'm very interested in, because I think the pandemic has the potential for systematic change.
In a good way. In a good way and a bad way.
It could be good and bad. So one of the things that has really intrigued me is recognizing just how pervasive social contact is in every aspect of our lives. And if we think about how the pandemic has changed our everyday lives, it has changed the way we are working. Many people working remotely now. It's changing education. It's changed how we're shopping, how entertainment, etc. There are social aspects of every aspect of this, right? And so each of these sectors potentially has a role to play in either making us more or less socially connected. If this pandemic changes how we design schools, how we design workplaces, how we design communities where people live, this could change the design of so many aspects of our lives that may potentially influence us socially long term.
Thank you so much, Julianne. This has just been great. My guest today has been Julianne Holt-Lunstad. She's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. If you get around to it, leave us a voicemail with your questions. The number is 201-472-0785. You can also write to us at askbillnye.com. I'm sure it's your homepage. I'm Bill Nye. This is a pandemic, and we are all in this together. And now, more than ever, my friends, science rules. And if you like Science Rules, Coronavirus Edition, please take a moment to rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. It helps us out, helps us find out what you want to hear about, and helps other people learn about the show. So thank you. Science Rules, Coronavirus Edition is produced by Harry Huggins and Corey S. Powell. Our editor is Tracy Samuelson. Our engineer is Luz Fleming, who also mixed this episode. Josephine Margarana is our executive producer. Special thanks to Casey Halford. Chris Bannon is the chief content officer at Stitcher. And at Stitcher, everyone, science rules. Three more things. Wash your hands, wear a mask, and get tested regularly.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind.
When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to monday.com.